And that is what everyone says you should be doing, right? I mean, that's what Oprah and Bill Gates did to get successful, right? No. Dreams are lovely, but they are just dreams, fleeting, ephemeral, pretty. But dreams do not come true just because you dream them. It's hard work that makes things happen. It's hard work that creates change. So lesson one, I guess, is ditch the dream and be a doer, not a dreamer. Maybe you know exactly what it is you dream of being, or maybe you're paralyzed because you have no idea what your passion is. The truth is, it doesn't matter. You don't have to know. You just have to keep moving forward. You just have to keep doing something, seizing the next opportunity, staying open to trying something new. It doesn't have to fit your vision of the perfect job or the perfect life. Perfect is boring, and dreams are not real. Just do. So you think, I wish I could travel. Great, sell your crappy car, buy a ticket to Bangkok, and go. Right now. I'm serious. You want to be a writer? Writer's someone who writes every day, so start writing. You don't have a job? Get one. Any job. Don't sit at home waiting for the magical opportunity. Who are you? Prince William? No. Get a job. Go to work. Do something until you can do something else. I did not dream of being a TV writer. Never, not once, when I was here in the hallowed halls of the Ivy League, did I say to myself, self, I want to write TV. You know what I wanted to be? I wanted to be Nobel Prize winning author Toni Morrison. That was my dream. I blue-skied it like crazy. I dreamed and dreamed. And while I was dreaming, I was living in my sister's basement. Dreamers often end up living in the basements of relatives, FYI. Anyway, there I was in that basement, and I was dreaming of being Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison. And guess what? I couldn't be Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison because Toni Morrison already had that job, and she wasn't interested in giving it up. So one day I was sitting in that basement and I read an article that said, it was in the New York Times, and it said it was harder to get into USC film school than it was to get into Harvard Law School. And I thought, I could dream about being Toni Morrison, or I could do. At film school, I discovered an entirely new way of telling stories, a way that suited me, a way that brought me joy, a way that flipped this switch in my brain and changed the way I saw the world. Years later, I had dinner with Toni Morrison. And all she wanted to talk about was Grey's Anatomy. That never would have happened if I hadn't stopped dreaming of becoming her and gotten busy becoming myself. Lesson two. That was lesson one. Lesson two is that tomorrow is going to be the worst day ever for you. When I graduated from Dartmouth that day in 1991, when I was sitting right where you are and I was staring up at Elizabeth Dole speaking, I will admit that I had no idea what she was saying. Couldn't even listen to her. Not because I was overwhelmed or emotional or any of that, but because I had a serious hangover. Like an epic, painful hangover. And here is where I might want to apologize to President Hanlon, because I know that you are trying to build a better and more responsible Dartmouth, and I applaud you, and I admire you, and it is very necessary, but I was really freaking drunk the night before. And the reason I'd been so drunk the night before, the reason I'd done upside-down margarita shots at Bonesgate, was because I knew that after graduation, I was going to take off my cap and gown, and my parents were going to pack my stuff in the car, and I was going to go home and probably never come back to Hanover again. And even if I did come back, it wouldn't matter, because it wouldn't be the same, because I didn't live here anymore. On my graduation day, I was grieving. My friends were celebrating. They were partying. They were excited, so happy. No more school, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? You get all the froyo you want here. The gym is free. The apartments in Manhattan are smaller than my suite in North Mass. Who cared if there was no place to get my hair done? All my friends are here. I have a theater company here. I was grieving. I knew enough about how the world works, enough about how adulthood plays out, to be grieving. Here's where I'm going to embarrass myself and make you all feel maybe a little bit better about yourselves. I literally lay down on the floor of my dorm room and cried while my mother packed up my room. I refused to help her. Like, hell no, I won't go. I've nonviolent protested leaving here. Like, went limp like a protester, only without the chanting. It was really pathetic. If none of you lay down on a dirty hardwood floor and cry today while your mommy packs up your room, you are already starting your careers out ahead of me. You are winning. The thing I really felt like I knew was that the real world sucks. And it is scary. College is awesome. You're special here. You're in the Ivy League. You are at the pinnacle of your life's goals at this point. Your entire life up until now has been about getting into some great college and then graduating from that college. And now, today, you have done it. The moment you get out of college, you think you're going to take the world by storm. All doors will be open to you. It's going to be laughter and diamonds and soirees left and right. What really happens is that to the rest of the world, you are now at the bottom of the heap. Maybe you're an intern, possibly a low-paid assistant. And it is awful. The real world, it sucked so badly for me. I felt like a loser all of the time. And more than a loser, I felt lost. Which brings me to clarify lesson number two. Tomorrow is going to be the worst day ever for you. But don't be an asshole. Here's the thing. Yes, it is hard out there. But hard is relative. I come from a middle-class family. My parents are academics. I was born after the Civil Rights Movement. I was a toddler during the Women's Movement. I live in the United States of America, all of which means I am allowed to own my freedom, my rights, my voice, and my uterus. And I went to Dartmouth and I earned an Ivy League degree. The lint in my navel that accumulated while I gazed at it as I suffered from feeling lost about how hard it was to not feel special after graduation, that navel lint was embarrassed for me. Elsewhere in the world, girls are harmed simply because they want to get an education. Slavery still exists. Children still die from malnutrition. In this country, we lose more people to handgun violence than any other nation in the world. Sexual assault against women in America is pervasive and disturbing and continues at an alarming rate. So yes, tomorrow may suck for you, as it did for me. But as you stare at the lint in your navel, have some perspective. We are incredibly lucky. We have been given a gift. An incredible education has been placed before us. We ate all the froyo we could get our hands on. We skied. We had EBAs at 1 a.m. We built bonfires and got frostbite and had all the free treadmills. We beer-ponged our asses off. Now it's time to pay it forward. Find a cause you love. It's okay to pick just one. You're going to need to spend a lot of time out in the real world trying to figure out how to stop feeling like a lost loser. So one cause is good. Devote some time every week to it. Oh, and while we are discussing this, let me say a thing. A hashtag is not helping. Hashtag yes all women, hashtag take back the night, hashtag not all men, hashtag bring back our girls, hashtag stop pretending hashtags are the same as doing something. Hashtags are very pretty on Twitter. I love them. I will hashtag myself in it next week. But a hashtag is not a movement. A hashtag does not make you Dr. King. A hashtag does not change anything. It's a hashtag. It's you sitting on your butt, typing on your computer, and then going back to binge watching your favorite show. I do it all the time. For me, it's Game of Thrones. Volunteer some hours. Focus on something outside yourself. Devote a slice of your energies towards making the world suck less every week. Some people suggest doing this will increase your sense of well-being. Some say it's good karma. I say that it will allow you to remember that whether you are a legacy or the first in your family to go to college, the air you are breathing right now is rare air. Appreciate it. Don't be an asshole. Lesson number three. So you're out there, and you're giving back, and you're doing, and it's working, and life is good. You are making it. You are a success, and it's exciting, and it's great. At least it is for me. I love my life. I have 3 TV shows at work, and I have 3 daughters at home, and it's all amazing, and I am truly happy. And people are constantly asking me, how do you do it? And usually they have this sort of admiring and amazed tone. Shonda, how do you do it all? Like I'm full of magical magic and special wisdomness or something. How do you do it all? And I usually just smile and say, like, I'm really organized. If I'm feeling slightly timely, I say, I have a lot of help. And those things are true, but they also are not true. And this is the thing I really want to say to all of you, not just to the women out there, although this will matter to you women a great deal as you enter the workforce and try to figure out how to juggle a work and family. But it will also matter to the men, who I think increasingly are also trying to figure out how to juggle work and family. And frankly, if you aren't trying to figure it out, men of Dartmouth, you should be. Fatherhood is being redefined at a lightning-fast rate. You do not want to be a dinosaur. So women and men of Dartmouth, as you try to figure out the impossible task of juggling work and family, And you hear over and over and over again that you just need a lot of help. We just need to be organized. We just need to try a little bit harder. As a very successful woman, a single mother of three, who constantly gets asked the question, how do you do it all? For once, I'm going to answer that question with 100% honesty here for you now. Because it's just us. Because it's our fireside chat. Because somebody has to tell you the truth. Shonda, how do you do it all? The answer is this. I don't. Whenever you see me somewhere succeeding in one area of my life, that almost certainly means I am failing in another area of my life. If I am killing it on a scandal script for work, I am probably missing bath and story time at home. If I am at home sewing my kids' Halloween costumes, I'm probably blowing off a rewrite I was supposed to turn in. If I'm accepting a prestigious award, I'm missing my baby's first swim lesson. If I'm at my daughter's debut in her school musical, I am missing Sandra Oh's last scene ever being filmed at Grey's Anatomy. If I am succeeding at one, I am inevitably failing at the other. That is the trade-off. That is the Faustian bargain one makes with the devil that comes with being a powerful working woman who is also a powerful mother. You never feel 100% okay. You never get your sea legs. You're always a little nauseous. Something is always lost. Something is always missing. And yet, I want my daughters to see me and know me as a woman who works. I want that example set for them. I like how proud they are when they come to my offices and know that they come to Shondaland. There is a land, and it is named after their mother. In their world, mothers run companies. In their world, mothers own Thursday nights. In their world, mothers work. And I am a better mother for it. The woman I am because I get to run Shondaland, because I get to write all day, because I get to spend my days making things up. That woman is a better person and a better mother because that woman is happy. That woman is fulfilled. That woman is whole. I wouldn't want them to know the me who didn't get to do this all day long. I wouldn't want them to get to know the me who wasn't doing. So lesson number three is that anyone who tells you they're doing it all perfectly is a liar. Okay. I fear I've scared you or been a little bit bleak, and that was not my intention. It is my hope that you run out of here excited, leaning forward into the wind, ready to take the world by storm. That would be so very fabulous for you to do what everyone expects of you, for you to just go be exactly the picture of hardcore Dartmouth awesome. My point, I think, is that it is okay if you don't. My point is that it can be scary to graduate, that you can lie on the hardwood floor of your dorm room and cry while your mom packs up your stuff. That you can have an impossible dream to be Toni Morrison that you have to let go of. That every day you can feel like you might be failing at work or at your home life. That the real world is hard. And yet, you can still wake up every single morning and go, I have three amazing kids, and I have created work I am proud of, and I absolutely love my life, and I would not trade it for anyone else's life ever. You can still wake up one day and find yourself living a life you never even imagined dreaming of. My dreams did not come true. But I worked really hard and ended up building an empire out of my imagination. So my dreams can suck it. You can wake up one day and find that you are interesting and powerful and engaged. You can wake up one day and find that you are a doer. You can be sitting right where you are now, looking up at me, probably, hopefully I pray for you, hungover. And then 20 years from now, you can wake up and find yourself in the Hanover Inn full of fear and terror because you were going to give the commencement speech. Dry mouth, heartbeat so fast, everything in slow motion, pass out, die, poop. Which one of you will it be? Which member of the 2014 class is going to find themselves standing up here? Because I checked, and it's pretty rare for an alum to speak here. Pretty much just me and Robert Frost and Mr. Rogers, which is crazy awesome. So which one of you is going to make it up here? I mean, I really hope that it's one of you, seriously. When it happens, you'll know what this feels like. Dry mouth, heartbeat so fast, everything moves in slow motion. Graduates, every single one of you, be proud of your accomplishments. Make good on your diplomas. You are no longer students. You are no longer works in progress. You are now citizens of the real world. You have a responsibility to become a person worthy of joining and contributing to society, because who you are today, that's who you are. So be brave. Be amazing. Be worthy. And every single time you get a chance, stand up in front of people. Let them see you. Speak. Be heard. Go ahead and have the dry mouth. Let your heart beat so, so fast. Watch everything move in slow motion. So what? You what? You pass out? You die? You poop? No. And this is really the only lesson you'll ever need to know. You take it in. You breathe this rare air. You feel alive. You be yourself. You truly, finally, always be yourself. Thank you. Good luck. Dartmouth commencement speech delivered June 8th, 2014, Hanover, New Hampshire. Chapter 6. Yes to Surrendering the Mommy War, or Jenny McCarthy is My Everything. I have an amazing nanny. She's wonderful and soulful. She has a sly sense of humor. I've seen her deliver a funnier joke with a single silent raise of her eyebrow than many stand-up comedians. She guards a very sensitive heart. Any human suffering brings her to tears. She's smart. Talk down to her and find yourself mentally slapped. She's an excellent judge of character and seems to know an original spirit from a forgery every time. Cross boundaries with her or her charges in any improper way and suffer the wrath of a lion. Get down on your hands and knees with her and the kids, and she will patiently teach and teach until something in you cracks open and you remember who you were as a child and begin to play. She's principled and firm. Rude behavior doesn't materialize in her presence. She's a grown-up who fully sees and knows children as citizens and people and souls. And because she respects children, all children seem to respect her. She is a goddess sent by the universe through the grace of the stars. Her name is Jenny. Jenny McCarthy. I'm not kidding. She has the same name as a well-known TV personality. A TV personality whose ideas about vaccinations my Jenny McCarthy does not happen to share, she'd want me to tell you. Jenny McCarthy says, vaccinate your kids. I hired Jenny McCarthy 15 minutes after I met her. At least, I tried to. She resisted. She had questions. She interviewed me. I was nervous. I knew immediately that Jenny McCarthy was a person I wanted in my house, with my family, around my children. I wanted to know her, and I wanted to have her know us. As Olivia Pope would say, trust your gut. I trusted my gut. I knew Jenny McCarthy was for us. She has a good heart. Once, in trying to describe her to someone, I referred to her as a new wave Mary Poppins. But really, that's not true. She's way more awesome than that Poppins chick. Have you watched that movie as an adult? I mean, really, butt in the seat, stare at the screen, watched that movie as an adult? Because if you ask me, Mary Poppins was not a very good nanny. All she had was a bag of endless objects and a kick-ass umbrella. Also, I'm pretty sure she was doing drugs and having sex with that chimney sweep. About 2 weeks after Jenny began working at the house, she looked at me thoughtfully and said, you know, I'm your nanny too. Because Shonda, you need a nanny. I think maybe I should have been insulted. I mean, she did just call me a child, right? I should have felt some outrage or some affront. Instead, what I felt overwhelmingly was relief. I had been out battling on the front line, doing the best I could against the enemy. But I was battered and bruised. Bombs kept dropping everywhere. I was tiptoeing around landmines left and right. I wanted to go home. I was losing the mommy war something terrible. I don't know about you, but the mistakes and missteps I have made since becoming a mother. Before kids, my confidence could not be dented. Now, it's shattered on a daily basis. I don't know what I'm doing. There is no manual. There is no checklist. There is no one to give lessons. These tiny humans have me caught up, trapped me behind enemy lines. I willingly enlisted, but did I do it for the right reasons? I worry that all I wanted was to look cute in the uniform. Or maybe be in the USO. Sing for the troops. Well, I can't sing, but I can play the oboe.
Give me the chance and I will play the hell out of an oboe for the troops. Instead, I am fighting. Front lines, holding a weapon. I'm not as brave as the others. Not as smart, or as strong, or as sure that I can make it. You know the character in the old war movies who always gets shot because he panics and runs? That character is me as a mother. I needed help. I needed fresh troops or more ammo or a medic or even just a chaplain for last rites for the love of... I got Jenny McCarthy. Jenny McCarthy is the SEAL Team 6 of nannies. I cannot count the number of times some nice reporter has placed a little battered silver recorder in front of my face, flicked it on, and with a kind smile, asked what I call the big questions. How do I manage work and home? What tips do I have for working moms? What is my secret to finding balance in a busy world? I get asked the big questions in almost every single interview I do. I hate the big questions. I hate being asked the big questions almost as much as I hate being asked the diversity question. Why is diversity so important? Which ranks for me as one of the dumbest questions on the face of the earth, right up there with, why do people need food and air, and why should women be feminists? But as much as I hate the big questions, I don't want to be rude to the very nice reporters who ask. I don't think the reporters mean any harm in posing the questions. I think people genuinely wonder. It's just that before this year of yes, I genuinely didn't know what to say. So I'd find myself smiling at reporters and giving a lot of different, odd answers. Why, Jane, I manage with a lot of organization and a label maker. I do laundry late at night, Susan. Gosh dang it, Bill, I started meditating on a regular basis. Yeah, right. Late-night laundry is the cure to getting three kids up and dressed, working a 12-hour day, making calls to my kids' tutors, scheduling doctor's appointments and playdates on my only 10-minute break, and then coming home to find that my 1-year-old finally walked and I missed it? Late-night laundry, my ass. Late-night laundry is not a true answer to any question ever. There is one answer to all of those reporters' big questions. I just didn't want to say it. Because no one else ever said it. I've read a lot of books written by and about working women, and I'm struck by the fact that no one ever seems to want to talk about having help at home, which I think is not so helpful to the women who don't have help at home. Let me put this in completely irrelevant and strange hair-related terms. God bless the soul of Whitney Houston, but I spent an hour every single morning of all 4 years of high school in front of the mirror trying to get my hair to look exactly like Whitney's hair. Hours and hours of my life given over to a hot curling iron and a bottle of hairspray and burned fingertips. To me, Whitney's hair was the definition of flawless. As a teenager in Coke bottle thick glasses who barely spoke at school and spent all her time inside books, nothing about my life was flawless. I somehow believed that everything would be better if I could just make my hair look like Whitney's. If my hair was flawless, my life would follow suit. Because clearly Whitney had it all worked out. I was at a hair salon in Los Angeles 5 or 6 years after graduating from college. For some reason, Whitney came up in the usual hair salon gossip. I casually mentioned to my hairdresser how much I'd loved her hairstyle when I was in high school, and then spun the story of my morning Whitney ritual. I made sure that I danced around the sad determination and kept the story funny. Gotta lay that track, gotta burn that campfire. So my hairdresser was still wiping tears of laughter from her face when she said it. Girl, she shook her head, you know that was a wig she had on, right? You can probably buy it if you want to. Hold on, let me get the wig catalog and show you. I did not hear another word she said. I was lost, thinking of the hours of wasted time and gallons of wasted hairspray. I relived the inevitable misery, the feeling of failure, and the insecurity that came every morning when my hair wouldn't do what I was trying to bully it into doing. And if I had known, if I had just been told, no matter how hard I worked, my hair was never going to look like that. If I had only known that not even Whitney's hair could look like that. I had to bite my lip hard to keep from bursting into tears right then and there in front of two ladies I didn't know. Black hair salons are no joke. I was going to be sitting across from these two ladies for at least 5 more hours. I did not want to be known as the fool who sobbed while she got her hair relaxed. I didn't cry, but it hurt. The betrayal ran deep. But I have to admit there was also a small sense of relief. Because now I knew I had not failed. I just didn't own the wig. Successful, powerful working mothers who keep silent about how they take care of their homes and families, who behave as if they maybe have a clone of themselves or possess Hermione Granger's time turner so they can be two places at once. Well, they are making everyone else get out their curling irons. Don't do that. Don't make me get my curling iron out for no reason. Jenny McCarthy is my family's nanny, and I am proud to say so out loud to anyone who asks. I am proud to say that I do not do this alone. I don't think powerful, famous women hide the fact that they have nannies or some kind of help at home because they're being unkind to other people. I mean, these women aren't at home laughing and laughing at how everyone out in America is trying to do it all and can't, because they don't know that the secret is that no one can do it all. Ha ha, we fooled you, sucker. I don't even think that's why my idol didn't tell us she wore the wig. Powerful women don't say out loud that they have help at home, that they have nannies, housekeepers, chefs, assistants, stylists, whatever it is they have to keep their world spinning. They don't say out loud that they have these people at home doing these jobs because they are ashamed. Or maybe a more precise way to say it is that these women have been shamed. Before my daughter Harper was born, when I was still filling out stacks and stacks of adoption paperwork, smiling for social workers and obsessing over baby clothes in stores, back when having a baby was more one of my brilliant ideas more than anything else, a working friend asked if I had started interviewing. Interviewing for what? I remember asking her. You know, a baby nurse, a nanny. She had a new baby herself, a little boy less than 6 months old. I can still picture her as she said this. She leaned forward in her chair, more intense than I thought the discussion merited, as if she was trying to tell me something important. And of course she was. She so was. She was wasting her time. I am never more sure of myself about a topic than when I have absolutely no experience with it. So with no baby of my own anywhere in sight, I was incredibly sure of myself as a mother. If I could slap myself, just reach back in time and wallop a good one across my face. Because what I did next. Look, it didn't feel like much at the time. In my defense, I wasn't yet a mother. I didn't know. I'm innocent. Ignorance is no excuse. What I did next was cruel. And from where I stand now, after 13 years fighting deep behind the enemy lines of the motherhood, I can tell you with certainty, any tribunal would call it a war crime. What I did next was launch a violent emotional ambush that left my unarmed sister wounded in the field. I looked at my friend. She had dark circles of exhaustion under her eyes. I'm pretty sure her hair hadn't been washed in weeks. She had blown her nose with baby wipes earlier. I took all of this in, and I said, "Why in the world would I hire someone to take care of my baby? I mean, seriously, that's just lazy. If I'm not willing to take care of my baby myself, why am I even having a baby in the first place?" I felt all the mighty righteousness in the world. Her face tightened. The air between us changed. I felt startled by her rage. Mom down, mom down. I can't tell you exactly how that meal ended, what was said, but I can tell you that she did not speak to me again. Ever. It wasn't until later that I got it. I had an 8-week-old Harper strapped to my chest in a snuggly. I was sweaty. My hair, which had been a cute afro puff a week or so ago, was now not merely dirty. It was a matted, terrifying afro mess that was going to be both painful and time-consuming to try to restore. The pajamas I wore had a stiff, hard patch of dried formula on the front. That stiff, hard patch acted as a fine bug repellent because it stank like nothing I had ever smelled before. I was seated in front of my computer, alternately sobbing from an exhaustion so total that I felt sure I could see the air moving in blue waves around the room, and trying to write dialogue for a movie I was supposed to have turned in a month ago. That was how stupid I was. I adopted a baby and still agreed to turn in a script for a movie a month later. If you have no children, trust me, that is beyond stupid. Later that evening, Christopher arrived. This is Chris number two for those of you keeping score, not my publicist, Chris. This Chris and I used to be roommates 100 years ago when we were both broke and struggling. Now he's a lawyer with a wife and an adorable son. I was best man at his wedding. He is Harper's godfather, and he takes that job very seriously. Every Sunday for the past 12 years, he has showed up at my door to spend time with his godchild, every single Sunday. He got married on a Saturday, and the next day he was at my house. I told him to go home. He told me it was Sunday in a tone that allowed no argument. He's not just a friend. He's family. So when Chris number two arrived that evening, he took one look at me and removed the baby from my arms. He gave me that smile you give a person who has the crazy, swirly eyes. He also took a big step back at the smell of me. "Go take a shower. Harper and I are going to watch ESPN. When I woke up an hour later, I was still in the shower, the now cold water causing me to shiver. I thought, I need help. I need to hire some help. I need to hire a lot of help, or I'm going to lose my job and my child and I are going to starve to death. I need to hire help or I won't make it. And I suddenly thought of my friend. I thought of what I had said to her. Mom down, mom down. I thought of what I had done to her. I'd shamed her. We've all been taught to shame and be ashamed, and why wouldn't we feel ashamed? How could we not feel ashamed? We're not supposed to have any help. We're supposed to do it all ourselves, even if we are working. So if you have kids and you get help to care for them, shame on you. Which is just rude and sexist. Caterina Scorsone, who also happens to play Amelia Shepherd on Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice, and I spend a lot of time ranting to each other about this issue. No man, she points out often, has ever had to apologize for having help in order to take care of his home and his kids, ever. Why do we? She has a point. Why do we? I mean, let's all remember that for most women, staying at home is not an option. Most women have to work. The majority of women, unless they are wealthy or financially cared for by someone else, have to work. Historically, women have always had to work. Women worked in the fields, women were maids, women raised other women's children, women were nurses, women worked in factories, women were secretaries, seamstresses, telephone operators. What was different in the past was that people lived closer to their families. Your mother watched your children, your aunt watched them, your sister, your cousin Sue. For some people, this remains true. For most people, you need help. And the crisis of childcare in this country is brutal and scary and expensive. It's a lot to handle. I'm betting you are having a hard time doing it all, feeling good about it, and making it all work. So it would not help anyone to pick up my book and read that I merrily tuck a giggling toddler under each arm with effortless ease and skip to my office, where I run two shows and produce two more while developing others as I laugh and laugh and sip champagne with celebrities while we all eat mounds of food and never gain a pound. It never, ever helps to think that Whitney's hairdo is real. Leave no mom behind, soldiers. And even with help, I'm still in the trenches. Nobody has this thing figured out. Except doesn't it feel like everyone else has it figured out? I don't know about you, but it's the idea that I'm not measuring up that gets me. I'm constantly worrying and wondering and feeling like I'm failing. Because everywhere I look, everyone else seems to be thriving. The women around me are smiling and their kids are smiling and their houses seem clean and it all looks so great on Pinterest and Instagram and Facebook. I am not an everything looks great mom. I am a barely hanging on mom. I am a hot mess mama. I have worn pajamas in the carpool line. Dirty pajamas. A long, long, long time ago, at one of the schools my daughter thankfully no longer attends, I was sitting in the back-to-school meeting that all schools have at the end of summer. After the principal gave a warm and rousing welcome, she invited the head of the PTA to the stage. Now, the head of the PTA was a school parent, a mom. A mom just like any other mom. If any other mom was tall, gorgeous, whip-smart, and, I gotta say it, practically perfect in every way. Perfect PTA mom very cheerfully began to tell us about the rules for the Friday bake sale rotation schedule that we were all expected to take part in. Now, why we were filling our kids up with sugary baked goods and why we were selling these baked goods in an effort to raise money when the tuition at the school already made me involuntarily shudder every time I thought about it was all beyond me. But there was a weekly bake sale and we all had to join in, for perfect PTA mom told us so. Finally, this perfect PTA mom finished up, just so we don't have any problems like last year, I just want to be clear. All of the baked goods must be homemade, something you make with your child. That's so much nicer. Now, maybe it's the Midwesterner in me, or the common sense in me, or the hot mess mama in me. It was something. Before I even knew it was happening, my mouth had opened, and I was speaking in a voice that carried loud and clear across the auditorium. Are you fucking kidding me? Really loud. 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 Heads whipped around in my direction. Try being that mom at your kid's school. I didn't even know I had that in me. But I did. I was mad. I was insulted. I have a time-consuming job. A job that I love. A job that I love and that I wouldn't trade for the world. But being a writer invades my brain 24 hours a day. I dream about the shows. The job takes from me in ways I never expected, and yet I am devoted to it. To the rush, to the track laying, to the work. I work. I have a job. People with jobs often do not have time to bake. But being a mother is also a job, Shonda. I can hear someone reading this book saying those words right now. You know what I say to that? No, it is not. Being a mother is not a job. Stop throwing things at me. I'm sorry, but it is not. I find it offensive to motherhood to call being a mother a job. Being a mother isn't a job. It's who someone is. It's who I am. You can quit a job. I can't quit being a mother. I'm a mother forever. Mothers are never off the clock. Mothers are never on vacation. Being a mother redefines us, reinvents us, destroys and rebuilds us. Being a mother brings us face to face with ourselves as children, with our mothers as human beings, with our darkest fears of who we really are. Being a mother requires us to get it together or risk messing up another person forever. Being a mother yanks our hearts out of our bodies and attaches them to our tiny humans and sends them out into the world, forever hostages. If all of that happened at work, I'd have quit 50 times already. Because there isn't enough money in the world. And my job does not pay me in the smell of baby head and the soft weight of snuggly sleepy toddler on my shoulder. Being a mother is incredibly important. To the naysayers, I growl, do not diminish it by calling it a job. And please, don't ever try to tell me it's the most important job I'll ever have as a way of trying to convince me to stay at home with my children all day. Don't. I might punch you in the nose. The most important job to a woman who has rent, has a car note, has utility bills, and needs groceries is the one that pays her money to keep her family alive. Let's stop trying to make ourselves indulge in the crappy mythological lady cult that makes being a mother seem like work. Staying at home with your children is an incredible choice to make, and it's awesome and admirable if you make it. Go you! Being a mother still happens if you don't stay home with your kids. It still happens if you get a job and go to work. It happens if you are an Army Ranger and you're deployed overseas and your kid is staying with your parents. Still a mother. Still not a job. Working or staying at home, one is still a mother. One is not better than the other. Both choices are worthy of the same amount of respect. Motherhood remains equally painfully death-defying and difficult either way. It does. It does. Let's all put down our weapons for a minute, okay? Perhaps you think that it is important to your child's personal growth to bake goods in your house. More power to you, my sister. I will defend your right to bake your brownies. I will march for your right to home bake whatever you damn well want to home bake. But I will take off my earrings and ask someone to hold my purse for the verbal beatdown we will need to engage in if you try to tell me I must define my motherhood in the same terms as yours. There's enough room for everybody here. This is a big, big maternity tent. If I want to buy my brownies from Costco and drop them off in a wrinkled brown paper bag still wrapped in the plastic and the foil container with the orange price sticker still attached, guess what? That's how it's gonna go down. Suck it, judges. I am not telling you to do it that way. You go bake your ass off. But we all have to acknowledge that our way is not the way. Did I judge your perfectly made, piping hot, double fudge chocolate cupcakes with the hand-whipped frosting? Did I judge the beautiful monogram cupcake holder with the coordinating starched apron you have on? No, I did not. Because you are my sister. Also because I'm going to eat all of your cupcakes. Look, I am devoted to my children, deeply. But my devotion has nothing to do with home-baked goods. It has nothing to do with making any kind of public show of maternal fabulousness, because you know me by now. Public displays of any kind of fabulousness are never going to happen for me. I am devoted to knowing my children, to reading books with them, to hearing the stories they tell me, and to the conversations we have, to making them citizens of the world, to raising strong feminist human beings who love and believe in themselves. That is hard enough for me without delivering home-baked goods to school on a Friday. I am never going to braid anyone's pigtails perfectly. No one's clothes are ever going to be ironed. Clean, yes. Ironed, not by me. We will never make special crafts for every holiday and then take photos of them to put on Pinterest and Facebook. Ever. Never. Ever. I will always be resentful of mom activities that take place on a Tuesday at 11 a.m., as if the mothers with jobs are not valued or welcome. And I am always going to yell, what the fuck, at the PTA meeting if you tell me the brownies need to be homemade. I am already in the middle of a great mommy war, and it is against my worst enemy, me. I don't need another war against you. I'm betting you don't need one either. Stacey McKee, who is one of the new head writers at Grey's Anatomy, but started out way back in the beginning as the assistant on the show, is the kind of mom who does crafts with her kids and puts photos of them up on Pinterest and Instagram. She works long, hard hours, but still, you go into her office, and as she's talking scripts and story, she's hot gluing beads onto a princess cape for her daughter. I always furrow my brow and ask her why the hell she is doing this. Why? Or why the hell is she delicately hand-painting vistas onto Easter eggs, or why is she doing any number of the crazy, amazing, crafty things Stacy is doing for her kids? For the love of wine, why? Stacy will furrow her brow back at me, equally confused. Why wouldn't I? She says. See, Stacy loves doing this stuff. She'd probably do it even if she didn't have kids. Oh, wait, I knew her back when she didn't have kids, and she was doing it. Stacy once spent days making incredibly lifelike renderings of all the Grey's Anatomy characters out of pipe cleaners. Pipe cleaners. So, it's not about working moms versus non-working moms. It's about people who love hot gluing beads on capes versus people who do not know what a hot glue gun is. And it's not even that. It's about the non-glue gun people not assuming that the glue gun people are judging them and vice versa. Maybe don't start out with your weapons raised. Maybe that perfect PTA mom didn't even realize that homemade brownies could be a hardship. Maybe instead of yelling obscenities at the mention of homemade brownies, it would be better to stand up and gently point out that not everyone has the time or the bandwidth to bake brownies. And if you are met with condescension, then yell the obscenities. This year at Emerson's new preschool, I was in charge of the cake for the end of the year party. I got lucky and found a bakery that can reproduce photos on a cake. I don't know how they do it, and I don't care. I ordered from the bakery and showed up at the party with my awesome store-bought cake. Every child's face smiling out of the frosting. Everyone oohed and aahed. I felt victorious in a sick, competitive, not allowed to play Scrabble, kicked off of team sports, maternal fabulousness kind of way. And then someone asked me where the cake cutter was. I brought the cake. I did not bring anything with which to cut the cake, or plates on which to eat the cake, or any utensils. At the other school, this might have been an international incident for me. Things might have escalated to nuclear levels. Arsenals would have been emptied. But now at this school, I said, the cake is so pretty. And I got a laugh, a friendly laugh. Then someone grinned and said, no big deal. I have some cake cutting stuff. And everyone just moved on. Cake was served. Cake was consumed. Everyone copied down the name of the bakery off of the side of the box. That was that. These moms leave no mom behind. I love it here. I don't think they are different from the moms at the other school. It is that I am different. All the moms were great all along. I just couldn't see it. Now, I'm no longer looking for the enemy, so I no longer see the enemy. And so finally, in this year, I allow myself to fully lay down my weapons. When a reporter flicks on that recorder, smiles, and asks the big questions, I do not call in the troops. I do not raise my shields. I allow myself to be seen. How do you manage work and home? What tips do you have for working moms? What is your secret to finding balance in a busy world? Yes, I can answer now. No hot glue gun, no home-baked goods, no late-night laundry. Leave no mom behind. Jenny McCarthy. To do it all, I have Jenny McCarthy. I feel really good. Of course, the reporter walks away deeply confused as to why Jenny McCarthy seems to figure so prominently in my life. But I don't care. I wave the white flag. There is victory in surrender. Curling irons down, my sisters. The mommy war has ended. Chapter 7. Yes to all play and no work. As the year of yes began to really go forward, something happened. I got busier and busier and busier. The more I said yes to things that challenged me, the more I had to leave the house. Saying yes had turned little cocooned me into a big social butterfly. I flew to New York to see Kerry Washington guest host Saturday Night Live. I went to private parties of incredibly interesting people. I threw a fundraiser for the Democratic National Committee. I helped host charity events. There were a lot of awards that year because now there was not only one show starring a black woman on Thursday nights, there were two. And all three shows on Thursday were from Shondaland. My publicist, Chris, was smartly taking advantage of the fact that I was saying yes and booking as many interviews as he could squeeze into my schedule. I did my first Good Morning America interview with Robin Roberts. I went with the cast of Scandal to The View. I was photographed by Annie Leibovitz. I did a live interview in front of an audience at the Smithsonian. I felt like I was everywhere. And I was everywhere, it seemed, but at home. Which makes sense. All the things that would challenge me happened outside my home. Inside my home, doing just fine. At least I thought I was. I mean, I was still a hot mess mama. I was still working too much. I still needed Jenny McCarthy to nanny both the kids and me. I still needed help. I still wasn't getting enough sleep. But I really thought I was doing fine. Except I started to feel irrelevant. In my own home. I'd come home and Emerson and Beckett would glance my way, give me a nod, and then continue playing. Like I was the nice neighbor lady visiting from next door. Or Harper would eye me with disdain when I asked her which friend she was talking about. And I'd realize that I'd missed a whole week's worth of discussions. A lifetime in tween years. And then I hit an emotional wall. One night I was all dressed up in a ball gown, hair and makeup done perfectly, borrowed diamonds shimmering on my neck and wrists, ready to head out to some event that I had said yes to. And as I walked through the foyer to the front door, my daughter Emerson came rushing towards me. "Mama," she was hollering, sticky hands outstretched. "Wanna play?" For a split second, it felt like time froze. Like in one of those action movies where everything goes into slow motion, then spins around, just before the hero dude. Because somehow in time-freezing slow-mo spin-around movies, it is always a dude. Kick someone's ass. But there's Emerson, her one curly tuft of hair bound into a valiant attempt at a ponytail on top of her head in a way that makes her look like Tweety Bird. She's frozen, then moving toward me in slow motion. Then the whole room is spinning around and I can see myself. The blue ball gown, the sticky hands, the child hurtling through space toward me. She's asked me a question. Wanna play? I'm late. I'm perfectly, elegantly dressed. Carolina Herrera made this gown. The shoes I'm wearing are some kind of navy lace that I find extremely painful, but damn, they look good on me. When I step out onto the stage, the speech I've written for this particular evening in tribute to a friend is funny and vibrant and moving. I know it will be a special moment, something the town will probably talk about the next day. My phone keeps buzzing repeatedly. It's Chris, my publicist. I really should be arriving just about now, but wanna play? There's that round face, big hopeful eyes. She's got Cupid red lips. I could bend down, grab her hands in mine before she touches me, give her a soft kiss and tell her, no, no, Mama has to go. Mama can't be late. I could. I'd be well within my rights. It wouldn't be unheard of. It would be okay. She'd understand. But in this frozen moment, I'm realizing something. She didn't call me honey. She's not calling everyone honey anymore. She's changing, right before my eyes. The baby who was on my hip that last Thanksgiving is going to be 3 years old on her next birthday. I'm missing it. And if I'm not careful, she's going to see the back of my head heading out the door, more than she'll see my face. So in that split second, everything changes. I kick off my painful high heels. I drop to my knees on the hardwood floor, making the ball gown poof up around my waist like some kind of navy confection. It's going to wrinkle. I don't care. Wanna play? She's asked. Yes, I say. Yes, I do. And I grab those sticky hands in mine, and Emerson plops herself down into my lap, laughing as the gown flies up around her. When I arrive at the venue 15 minutes late, the navy ball gown is hopelessly wrinkled and I'm carrying my heels in my hand. But I don't care. There's a hot pearl of joy in my chest that is warming me in a way I'd forgotten was possible. That little fire inside me has been reignited. Like magic. Let's not get carried away. It's just love. That's all it is. We played, Emerson and I, and we were joined by Beckett and then later Harper. There was a lot of laughing. I gave my best reading of the finest book ever written, Everyone Poops. There may have been some dancing and singing to a made-up funky disco version of Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes. There were sticky kisses. Beckett jammed her finger into my nose out of curiosity. Emerson put her head against my chest and listened until she heard my heart. Then she looked at me solemnly. You are still alive. Yes, I am. Days like this, I am still alive. We finish with our daily performance of that damned gorgeous song Idina Menzel sings in Frozen that has some sort of Pied Piper magical hold on all children. Then I got in the car to go to the event, happy. That warm joy in me, feeling fundamentally changed. Like I knew a secret that very few people get to learn. But really, it's just love. That's no secret. It's just something we forget. We could all use a little more love. A lot more love. I am not a naturally optimistic person. I'm too in my own head to be a constant source of cheer. I have to work at happy. Dark and twisty is where my brain likes to settle. So I can use some reminders of what is good and optimistic and glass half full about this world. And nothing does that for me like the faces and souls of my tiny humans. That night I come home and engage in what I call the Hollywood single mom part of my evening, which involves my forcing the nearest awake human over 4 feet tall to free me from whatever dress and undergarment contraptions my glam team trapped me in hours before. There have been times in New York where the task has fallen upon a very nice hotel maid. A couple of times, actors from my shows have saved me. Once in Martha's Vineyard, I was forced to ask the very proper older gentleman who was my driver for the afternoon. "Are you judging? I see that look on your face. Uh-uh. What did I say at the beginning of this book? Well, you are definitely not going to come up here all the way in the middle of this book and judge me. It was either ask or spend the entire night sleeping in a white cocktail dress." This time, thankfully, I can ask my babysitter. There's a corset involved, and as soon as there's air flowing back into all parts of my lungs, I pull on a robe and go stick my face around doorways to peek at my sleeping kids. Staring at each of my girls, I make a decision. Whenever Emerson or Beckett or Harper in her own way asks, "Want to play?" I am always going to answer, "Yes." Always. Because if I have to have a dress removed by a stranger, I should at least get to do something I enjoy. I should at least get to see that happy look on their faces. Get a little more love. And so that's what I do. I actually do it. Want to play? From now on, the answer is always yes. I drop whatever I am doing, and I go to my children, and I play. It's a rule. No, I've made it more than a rule. I've made it law. Canon. Text. It's a religion. There's a strict obedience to it, something that I practice with fervor. Imperfectly, but faithfully. Unquestioningly. Making it such a steadfast rule allows me to peel away some of the work pressure I put on myself. To know that I don't have a choice means that I don't feel any guilt stepping away from my workaholic tendencies. I feel no remorse dumping my purse and coat on the floor just as I'm walking out the door to head to the office when I hear those two magic words. Wanna play? Those two words have me out of my shoes and sitting at a tiny pink tea table, coloring a bunny or playing with an unfortunate one-eyed baby doll or staring at lizards in the garden in an instant. It's hard to nail down a tween. If you have one, you know what I mean. I vividly remember being 12 years old. I sometimes wonder how my parents allowed me to survive. At that age, the existence of one's parents is nothing more than an embarrassment. Clearly, a 12-year-old is never going to say, "Want to play?" But with Harper, I've learned to look for the words and signs that mean the same thing. If she wanders into my room in the evening and lies down on any piece of furniture, I put down what I'm working on and give her my full attention. Sometimes that pays off. Sometimes it doesn't. But what I've come to understand is that letting her know my full attention is available is more important than anything else. Also, I've discovered something about this tall, gangly girl I love so much that sometimes she has to say, "Please stop hugging me," so I will stop. I really like her. She's interesting. I'm discovering her. She's like an endless mystery. I can't wait to see how she's going to turn out. It may be different for you, your happy place, your joy. The place where life feels more good than not good. It doesn't have to be kids. My producing partner, Betsy Beers, would tell me that for her, that place is her dog. My friend Scott would probably tell me that for him, it is spending time being creative. You might say it's being with your best friend, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, a parent, a sibling. It's different for everyone. For some of you, it might even be work. And that, too, is valid. This yes is about giving yourself the permission to shift the focus of what is a priority from what